This was an interview done with Christine Skillens, a Teton Sioux, who was born in 1920. The interview was done on February 21, 1979, by Brooke Hobson.
Do you want to start just by telling me some of your background and about your grandparents?
Well, I was born on the Indian reservation, really in a traditional Indian way. In fact, I was born way out in the, I guess way out in the boondocks, you know, and they never, like they didn't put out, I don't even have a birth certificate because there was no record.
Mm-hmm. What about your grandparents?
My grandfather was one of the sons of Crazy Horse that was killed, you know, the guy that bought Custer. But they, from what I heard, was that he was one of his sons that, well, according to my grandma, she said he was nice. He didn't like to fight. And he tried to make peace with everybody, you know, and he didn't believe in going to war. So anyway, he had two of the brothers, I think, and they all settled down in this wonderful place. My grandma, she came from Canada. She was one of the Canadian Indians. And they ran away, I guess, from, because the soldiers were looking for them, and they all went up to Canada and stayed up there for 7 years when they came back down.
So what state were you born?
North and South Dakota, mainly. They just, well, I guess it was all one. They just divided up because to them it's just one big old country. They just go back and forth like they do up into Canada, too. They just go across the border. There is no, like down here to Mexico, that they have guards or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's that way among the non-Indians, but the Indians, there's a lot to go back and forth.
Well, so your parents were born in North and South Dakota?
Yeah, my mother was born in North Dakota, my father was born in South Dakota. And it's a reservation now, but before it used to be just a wild country all around.
Were they in the same area? Like, how did they meet one another?
Oh, that's another story that they didn't meet, actually. It's one of the traditional marriages that they made a deal with. My grandparents made a deal with my other grandparents. And they set up this. My mother didn't see my dad till the day before they were married. So she didn't have any idea what he looked like or anything.
How old was she?
She was only 15 or 16.
Did they trade things back and forth for the husband and wife?
Well, it was more like I guess you'd say a dowry that they'd bring, but actually it was more like each side gave them stuff to set up housekeeping. Like my paternal grandfather, he gave them somebody had a horses and cattle, and then they had a house built for them.
What was the ceremony like?
Oh, it's just a simple ceremony that the Sioux have. It's like they smoke the peace pipe, and then they take this vows, and they wrap them in one blanket, and that's the whole. Thing, it's like giving them a ring, you know, because if they ever break apart, then they have to split that blanket. So it's saying that you're both under one blanket, you know. But they're going back to it, though, because my daughter was married the same way last summer.
She was?
Mm-hmm. Up in Dakota did have a big Sundance. And she and her husband got married under the Indian law.
So when your parents got married, what was the house like they lived in?
Oh, well, by that time, see, the government was giving them a place. You know, they start the reservation by the time. So they built them a, well, this house actually was built for my grandparents. But they weren't used to living in a house, so they didn't want to live in it.
Where did they live?
They lived out, you know, like the old-fashioned, they used to have a, what they called it, a tent, you know, with plenty of teepee. And they just liked to live there all the time. So they could pack up and move if they wanted to, you know. And so the house that was built for them by the government, they gave it to my mother and my dad.
What was the government house? What year was it your parents got married?
Oh, I couldn't say. This was 18. No, it was the beginning of 1918, because the First World War was going on. And a lot of the Indian boys had gone into it. And the way I remember is because I had an uncle that went into the service, mm-hmm. and he came back. Mm-hmm. And from what I hear was he'd been decorated with some honors or something. But I guess when he came back, that was, I guess, 1920. It was 1919 when he came back, and I was born in 1920. And no, it was 1920 when he came back, because I was born at Christmas time. Well, I didn't know what Christmas was, but we all celebrate my birthday. Anyway, from what I hear, they had a big ceremony for him, you know, welcoming mm-hmm. him back and everything, and of course, about that time I was born, so that's how they gave me an Indian name. In honor of him.
What's your name?
Kills many. And that meant that he killed a lot of enemies over in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So for the longest time I never knew what that it stood for, mm-hmm. but that was a story that was told to me.
So were you born in the house?
No, I was born out there when my grandmother and I lived. In North Dakota, so we used to go back and forth, you know. And mainly, it seemed like my childhood was spent mostly with the whole tribe. It seemed like I was here and there. Everybody was had something to do with my raising me. Yeah, and it's I couldn't do nothing that everybody knew about it. You know. If somebody disciplined me about something, it wasn't just one person.
Mm-hmm. So you lived a lot with your grandparents?
Well, that's the way it was. You know, it's, we had what they call a close-knit, it's like a, well, that's what back there they call it, the clan. And my father's clan was Sitting Bull's people, you know, they call them Hunkpapas in our language. So it was a group, and they're all relatives.
Mm-hmm. So an extended family.
Uh-huh, and they, mainly they all lived, you know, right close to one another.
And this is in the government housing?
No, it was on, along the banks of the Mara River up there. And we had this house, but I don't know, we stayed there, but we were always going, you know.
Now, when you're going, is this to Canada or to
North Dakota? No, to North Dakota or back to South Dakota. Everybody would gather in one spot. It seemed like we always stayed in one spot, you know. And then there were just a few times that we would go home, and then we'd be by ourselves with my mother and dad and my kids, you know.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Oh, yeah, I have 7 sisters, not 2 brothers. So we had a large family.
Where were you? Were you the oldest?
I'm the oldest of the girls, but my brothers are older than me.
Were they all born at home, or
mm-hmm.
was there a midwife there, or what was the
my grandma and my grandfather delivered all of us. My grandfather used to always tell how he delivered me. Oh, they would tease, you know, about
Is there a ceremony involved with
child? Well, after the child is born, then they have a, it's like a christening ceremony, but it's like they call it introduction into the world. And we are supposed to, it's like they give us a name and I don't know, it's decided who is going to bring us, you know, up and all that, you know, either the paternal grandparents or the maternal grandparents that have a face. With us it was my paternal grandparents, because my father had so many brothers, you know, and to me they were my fathers too. He didn't call them, you know, my uncles and whatever.
Well, was one of them a shaman at all, or?
Now, my grandmother was a medicine woman. See, in our tribe, the women are the, it's called matriarch society. You know, the women have a face in them. Well, we sort of, the men have the honor, you know, they get all the glory and everything, but it's the women that actually run, but we're sort of in the background all the time. We don't get out there. So the most powerful medicine women are from, you know, the older women like that. But they never come out and say, well, she was a medicine woman. Because like in history books, they'll say, well, Sitting Bull was a medicine man. And he had these powers and everything. What they actually didn't know was his mother. So she sort of, you know, put him out in front.
So you would go to her if anyone was sick, or
and people came from around.
What kind of things would she do?
Oh, she used mainly herbs and different. One of these you're gonna laugh. I remember my sister and I. We had a real bad cold. We were really sick, and she came up there because they called her. So she came in there and she had this thing, you know, and we didn't know. It was some kind of oil. It was skunk oil. I'll never forget that. You think you'd taken cod liver oil or castor oil?
Oh, you had to drink it.
Yeah, at 2 big teaspoons, you know, tablespoons.
Didn't help your cold.
Yeah, the next day we were up and running around, you know. I made up my mind I was never going to take that stuff. And then one time we had a sore throat. Well, she took a piece of, it was like bacon or something, you know. And she put it on her throat and tied something around her. And she said, now go outside and play. So we're out there playing. All the dogs in the neighborhood was after us. And they smelled that.
Oh, no.
But she used all kinds of stuff.
Well, did she have the medicine bundle? I know I've read about that. Did she?
Yeah, but I don't know what, we used to, that was, one of my sisters and I, we were so nosy, we used to ask her what was in there. And she said she would tell us, you know, one time, she opened it, you know, but of course I didn't know what was in it, but I know it was several little bundles, you know, and she named a couple of them, but the rest of it she didn't say.
What is it? What does it look like? Is it a leather pouch?
Yeah, it's made out of a skin, and it was, hers was all kind of beaded, real fancy one. And inside she had little, these little leather pouches with certain leaves and stuff like that.
Did she carry it with her all the time? How did she look? What did she wear?
She dressed the traditional Indian way. She used to have a long, she used to dance at the powwow. She had a real beautiful costume. It was all put upon quilt. And she wore moccasins all the time. I don't think I ever saw her in a pair of shoes.
Did she make all her own clothes?
That's how I learned beading and there's quill work and how to tan, you know, skin.
How did you dress? How did your brothers and sisters
dress? Oh, well, see, after She used to, I think I wore moccasins till then the government came along and said we had to go to school. Well, then I had to learn how to wear other clothes. But every time I went down there, she'd always tell me, put on some moccasins down there.
Before you went to school, what kind of games did you play, and who did you play with, and did you have toys?
Oh, all of our toys are what we made up ourselves. You know, we have to learn to entertain ourselves with whatever we had on hand.
Like what kind of things?
Oh, just anything. And we have to have a good imagination. Well, one time I remember my brother, he was out of my, I tell my kids that they laugh, you know, because my uncle went hunting. He brought home some rabbits. So my grandmother was going to cook them up, and they were skinning them and everything. So we're sitting there watching, you know. Well, he takes the intestines, you know, because she threw them aside. He picked it up, and he was playing with them, you know. He's running, and then he threw them, and the little towel would fall, you know. So I was yelling, let me do it, let me do it. He wouldn't. He said, no, he said, and he was running with it. And I remember I cried because he wouldn't let me do it. I don't know why I wanted to pull one of the dogs. But things like that, you know, we never really had any toys or anything. Of course, one of my mother's sisters, she used to make us these corn husk dolls, and we mm-hmm. played with them. But mainly we played with, like we used to always have, little kitty cats or little puppy dogs, you know. And we played with them just like dolls.
Mm-hmm. Were there other children besides just your family?
Oh, yes. My mother's brother, he had a big family, and their children. It was a whole bunch of kids. Now I don't even remember some of them. When I go home, my mother tells me so-and-so, and then I'll kind of remember that. That's about, it seems like a long time ago. Mm-hmm. Because I see the young kids, you know, and they'll say, oh, this is so and so's daughter, you know. And mm-hmm. it's kind of hard to believe. You
know? Well, this wasn't reservation land to start with. Do you remember when it became a reservation, when the government mm-hmm. came in?
I guess about the time that I started going to school, that's when they really started putting in. Well,
when was that?
About 19, I guess I was about 6 years old, so most of them by 1926. But see, 1924 is when they had this Dawes Act. It's supposed to be, Indians were supposed to become citizens, which was kind of a ripoff, you know, because they let you become a citizen, and they give you that piece of land, that you are a citizen, so you're on your own, and you had to get out there and just...
Yeah, how did your parents feel about that? Do you remember them talking about that?
My parents didn't go for it. They didn't want to. They just got their piece of land, but they refused to become citizens, because you had to sign the papers and everything. Mm. And I remember, the only thing I remember, they were saying, they used to say, because they couldn't say citizen, they'd say citizen, and that was their way of saying it, you know. But I heard that they were given a certain amount of money, too, to go with this.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know, somebody in our family went for it. And he found out that the next year, a couple years afterwards, that he was supposed to pay taxes on his land. And he didn't know this, so he never paid taxes. So the state of South Dakota came, took his land away. And there he was, left without his. So this was going on, so that's about the same time that the reservation mm-hmm. was formed. The ones that wanted to stay there on the reservation.
Mm-hmm. Were you, I meant to ask you, were you speaking your native tongue then, or were you speaking, like you said, your parents couldn't say citizen? I wonder, was it a different...
Yeah, I couldn't speak English until I started to school.
Oh, that's when you learned it.
Yeah, because when I went to the government schools, And they told you, you had to speak English. If they heard you speaking your language, you got punished.
Were you the only one of the kids that went to school?
No, I think nearly all my sisters did except one. And then she was kind of hard of hearing, so she went for a while and she sort of dropped out.
So tell us something about school, like how they came and said that you had to go to school and how you
went
to school as well.
Everything was under them. I see that I guess the BIA used to be under the War Department in those days. Everything is like military regulations. So the soldiers would come down there and they would threaten everybody. All the parents that didn't put their kids in school, that they would be taken away and put in jail. And so they'd come around and check, you know, where the kids were and everything.
So and any kid that was there had to be in school?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you were 6 years old, you had to be in school.
How far away was the school from you, where you were?
Oh, the school that I went to was up in Bismarck, North Dakota, which is about 150 miles from where their reservation was, our reservation.
When did you see your family then?
Not until the summertime.
And just for a couple of weeks?
No, we got to go home for 3 months.
Oh, yes. What was the school like?
Oh, I guess it could have been, you know. But everything, like I say, was like a, you know, military rule. And this is kind of funny because it seemed like all my life I went to these boarding schools and I was always under this regimentation, you know. So what do, you know, when the war breaks out, I go into the service.
Did, so that's when you started wearing shoes and they made you speak English. And they gave you all your clothes and...
Oh, yeah, it was, we were all our meals and everything, you know. But they wanted us to forget anything about, you know, our culture. They just wanted to wipe it off. And they told us we had to do this and that to belong to the society. We had to be this way and that way. And I guess we went along with it because they used to do a lot of threatening and we did get punished a lot.
What would they do?
Sometimes you get punished, you'd have to stand in a corner for hours, or sometimes you had to scrub the floors, or sometimes you were out there in the cold picking up trash or something.
What were they punishing you for? What was your
doing? Every little thing, you know. Like I said, like the military, so you had to get them, and we had companies. And if it came time for meal time, you had to get line up, everybody would get into companies like you and in service. And they'd have roll call.
Is this boys and girls together?
Well, the boys had their own dormitories and we had our own. But we all ate in the same dining room, the boys sat one side and the girls sat one side. But at these times, now sometimes, you know, like you would talk to your friend or something, they catch you talking, you know, or just making the least little noise. Right away they pull you out of line and you're punished for something, you know. And every time it turned around it seemed like it was like it was winter time, it's cold, and these daddy's old fashioned overshoes, we used to call them. They had these four buckles and they made out of like canvas. So I don't know, like all these young kids, you get a fad how to wear your certain clothes. So somebody got the bright idea of putting the tops down like a cup, you know. They told us we weren't supposed to do that. But we still did it, you know, outside, you know, we'd be. So when the school bell rings, we all get in line, you know. Everybody makes sure, you know, they pull their overshoes up. So this one time, there were several of us, you know, we had them. So we got in line and we started pulling up fast, but this teacher was coming down in cuffs. So he made us step up, you know. Everybody else went to class, so he had to stand there, and then he takes a big old ruler to just cross the hands. You know. But that's where I learned that I used to think, ooh, I used to get so angry and I couldn't do nothing, you know. But I used to just think to myself, I'll show them. And I think it's because we didn't cry, and that's what used to make us so. Mm-hmm. Oh, some of those teachers, I think they felt like killing us, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, the teachers were. How did that make you feel about my feeling?
I don't know, mainly. I don't have nothing against, you know, white people as a rule. The ones that I can't stand is the ones that come around preaching religion, because that's what they were, most of them were. Mm-hmm. Real religious, like Quakers and and well, one school I went to was run by the Catholic nuns, and they were something else. But all these teachers were, it seemed to me a lot of them were like old maids and spinsters, you know, and that's all they had to do was just try to discipline us and be mean and
made you rebellious.
But religion was the main thing, you know. They expected us to live up to certain things, you know, that the religion taught. But so now I don't, you know, like I guess that's the reason I don't belong to any church now. I refuse to go to church.
What had your exposure to religion been before you went to church?
Oh, it's see, ours is a traditional Indian religion. It's more of a three, well, they teach us that there is a great spirit and that we have to believe. But we do it in our own way. And somewhere along the line, we learn what's right and what's wrong. And we don't need people telling us or pounding in our heads, you know. But when I went there, see, they started, it was the first school I went to was Catholic. And they told me right away I was a Catholic and I had to do this and I had to do that. And it was all weird. I don't know what, you know. And then they taught me these prayers. And to me, they didn't mean nothing. I learned them, but the words didn't have no meaning. So I would, you know, say them off like you were reciting a poem or something. And I used to think, you know, what kind of religion is this, you know? Because I thought that I should pray to God in my own way, you know, the way I wanted to, what I wanted to say. So it was really kind of a confusing life that I had. But and some other was good points to it, I guess.
Like what?
Like I was telling you, I was one of my teachers, she was in a behavioral science or something. And I told her, I said, you know, one thing that was good about the BIA school, I learned how to eat a lot of different vegetables. And that's about all we got was just a, you know, well-balanced meal. It wasn't fancy. But I ate spinach that came out of my ears. So I said, maybe that's why I lived so long.
What did you eat at home?
Oh, for my grandparents, it was all mostly wild game and like wild plants, you know. We had wild turnips, wild onions. We did have potatoes and wild tomatoes and all the different kinds of fruits, you know, and nuts and stuff like that.
And your grandmother always prepared those?
Mm-hmm. Well, my mother learned how to do that too. Mm-hmm. After a while, she said. But it wasn't so bad.
Well, what were the roles like? Like, what was your mother doing most of the day, and what was your father, and what would he be doing most of the day?
Well, it's like I say, when I came along, that's about the time they were put on a reservation, and they were expected to try to live civilized life, we call it. So my father was given cattle, so he was trying to learn how to be a cattle rancher. And then my mother, they used to have a, like they call it, agricultural field agent that came around. And they had a lady that, she was a home economic field agent. Mm-hmm. And she came around and taught the Indian women, you know, how to prepare meals and how to utilize, you know, different things. So my mother, she kind of went along with that. And they put in a garden, planted carrots and all of them. So she learned how to can, you know, because this lady used to come around and hold these classes. So I remember she was going into all the things that she was learning. And she got a sewing machine too, you know. She started learning how to sew clothes. So she started making us all kinds of dresses and coats, you know. They were mainly from hand-me-downs because people were, they used to have that mission there and they used to bring what they call a mission box. Mm-hmm. From Chicago. These rich people would donate clothing. So she'd go down there and they'd give her different things. Well, she would take like a woman's coat, you know, and then she'd cut it down, make a coat for me or my sisters. You know. So they were just, I think, in between the whole transition.
Yeah. So did you have things of tradition and?
Yeah. And then after we went to school, so we were becoming more and more, I guess, civilized.
End quote. What were some of the traditional clothes you like? You'd wear those at home, or would you wear the things your mother had sewn?
Well, before I went to the school, it was mainly the traditional Indian clothing that I wore.
Tell me about what
I used to have like a little buckskin dress. My grandma had. It was all decorated with fringes, and then I wore these moccasins and leggings, and I used to have long hair too, and it was all, you know, braided. But after, when I went to that Catholic school, that was another thing. They cut my hair. They didn't think that, well, I guess it was mainly because nobody was there to comb and brush my hair, so they figure it was easier to take care of, so they just cut it. And then after that, you know, well, when I went home, I just started wearing ordinary clothes and everything.
It seems like your parents would, what did they think about when they saw you again after the way you left and the way you came back?
Oh, they didn't, I guess they were very sad, but there was nothing that could be done, you know. And because I really paid for one of my classes, and I was thinking about that. And I thought, when I'd go home, it seemed like my parents were different, you know, from what. But what I didn't realize at the time, it was I that changed so much. And they were the ones that were hurt, you know, more than I was. Because I was growing up and I could more or less go one way or the other, you know, I had that chance. But with them, that was their life, and it was kind of hard for them to change.
Do you think they resented that at all?
Yeah, they did. But I don't know, among my people, they don't show their feelings so much. So they don't say nothing. My grandparents, I don't know, it's kind of a hard thing to understand because my parents, see my dad, he went to school, I think they both went up to about the fourth or sixth grade, I think. So that's how they learned to speak English. Well, my grandparents couldn't speak a word of English. But this little town that they lived in was being settled by German farmers. And I always remember one of them was a Welsh town, Franz Welsh. Mm-hmm. And they became good friends with my grandparents. But the funny part of it was my grandparents didn't speak English at all. And the Welks, they didn't speak English either, but they spoke German. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how they communicated, but they were really good friends. They used to come down and they'd bring my grandma eggs and butter. And my grandfather would exchange them because they were putting up these fences on the farm. And he had a lot of land there with trees and everything. So he would take a load of, they said there were fence posts to put up these barbed wire fences.
Mm-hmm.
And firewood and stuff like that.
Hmm.
And I was about, I don't know, about 8 years old. I guess one of my mother's sisters got married, or her brother. Well, all these Germans in that little town, Strasbourg, they said they was going to give him a wedding dance. Well, my grandma and them didn't know. But they went along with it because, you know, they were all friendly. So they said, okay. So I remember they called it a Bowery dance. It was out in the open, you know, they had to put a flooring and then they put these little branches on the side. And I always remember that I heard them saying, you know, our Lord Welk is going to play. And he was playing his accordion. And there was all these German dances, you know, the Schottisch and all. But my sister and I were watching, and we went to sleep in the somebody had a big old car. I don't know who it belonged to. One of those, it was one of my uncles or something. So I remember they told us to lay down and go to sleep, and we went to sleep
in the car.
Uh-huh. But I didn't know when I came out here, you know, I see the Lord's Welk, you know. But I told somebody one time, I said, I know his parents. And they said, why don't you call him up? And I don't like his music now anyway.
When you, I meant to ask you, when you're talking about your grandparents, are you mean your maternal or your paternal?
My maternal grandparents.
Is that who you always were around, your maternal?
Well, I was around both of them, but I guess it was half and half.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go to one side and come back. We went back to South Dakota, I'd be around my paternal grandparents.
Oh, they lived in South Dakota.
And then the other one lived in North Dakota. So we were always just back and forth. It was kind of a hard life, you know, but like we heard about the Depression in the 30s. But I always say, well, we never noticed it,
mm-hmm.
because you can't miss what you never had.
That's right, so it didn't really affect you.
No, it was just the same old life, you know, and we did. It wasn't any worse than this. But I always remember when, I think it was Roosevelt was running for president. The Republicans there, because the South Dakota is a Republican state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing. They still do that back there, that I don't know if the Indians could vote in those days, but it was kind of, now that I think about it, I think there was a lot of hanky-panky going on. Anyway, they would come down and put on a big, like they call it, a feast for the Indians, you know. They'd butcher a couple of head of steers and they'd barbecue it. So all Indians on the reservation would come, you know. And then they'd have some campaign speakers,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
talking about if so-and-so's elected president,
yeah.
what they're going to do for the Indians, and they'll have a better life and all this. So all Indians would say, yeah. I never really knew what, if they really thought about voting for that
mm-hmm.
guy or what, you know.
So you think they were probably fairly skeptical about what they were saying?
Mm-hmm. Because from what I know now is that my people, they after the way they were treated, we were the ones that got really, I think, a lot of the Indian tribes, of all of them, I think, we were the ones that, they said we were the last ones to be conquered, and then we got the dirtiest deal of all. Like now, I think a lot of Indians, you know, they're like on their reservations, they have something going for them. And I always say, well, see, I come from an awful poor reservation. We don't have nothing, you know.
What contact did you have besides government people coming out to the reservation? Did you have contact with other people? Did you go to was there a village or a town close by that you would have to go into supplies?
Oh, well, on the reservation, see, the agency was on Fort Meigs, North Dakota. They had two, what we call them, trading posts. They were run by white people. Well, this guy, and he was with the Custer's troops there, the 7th Cavalry. Well, now, they were there, Major McLaughlin. Well, he married one of the Indian women on reservation. Oh, he had a big family. To this day, they're on a reservation. Seemed like every other person is named McLaughlin. So it was one of his brothers that opened up this trading post. It was like a general store, you know, he sold everything. So that was the only place that the Indians could, you know, do their trading. Of course, nobody had any cars or nothing. And for the longest time there, I remember my father, and they just had a team of horses, and we used to have one of these big old lumber wagons that we'd travel around. And a lot of the young kids would get around on horseback.
What kind of things do you bring to trade?
Oh, mainly food, and then it was like cotton goods, you know, like materials that the Indian women used to make dresses.
What would your father bring now to trade with him?
Oh, well, by then, see, like he was supposed to be a cattle rancher. So they would sell some of the cattle, and once a year, you know, and he'd get a check, you know.
Oh, so he was just using regular money.
Uh-huh. But the thing of it, see, it was throughout the year, he could go there and get stuff on credit.
Mm-hmm.
But when he got that check for his cattle, I don't think he got anything out of it, because it was just turned over, because he owed it all by that time.
He had everything.
That's the way those trading posts made their money. Mm-hmm.
What do you think the attitude of the people at the trading post were toward the Indian people?
Well, being this was that Major McLaughlin's brother, he and his wife, I think, got along pretty good with the Indians. Well, they had to, you know, and it was their business there, and they had to get along with everybody else. I don't know if the Indians might have run them off the reservation or something, but it seemed like they were always pretty nice. Although I've heard, like now they say, I don't know who, they still have that trading post there. But when I went back there, if they go in tomorrow on fancy stuff like a TV dinners and all that stuff. But somebody was telling, one of my daughters, she was telling me that, oh, she said, you should see the prices. She said, they're really, she said, they're out of this world. She said. Mm-hmm. And she was telling me, now that all the young Indian mothers have learned to use Pampers, that's all they sell in there. And she said, I thought Pampers out here were high.
Mm-hmm.
But she says, my God, she said, they're double what they are. She said, they're. And then you have to go buy them first. And we went to one of my nieces. She lived there. They have what they call a complex or something. It's like a condominium, but not this fancy. But she lives there. And They have a community kitchen.